It is Tuesday, July 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the mission to save 12 Thai boys and their football coach ends successfully.
They were aided by the fact that they had several days to practice and drill some of the skills that they needed.
President Donald Trump nominates the conservative-leaning Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And students in Virginia learn about science by building guitars. It's all ahead. Thai Navy SEALs say all 12 members of a youth football team and their coach have been pulled out of a flooded Thai cave. All 13 had been trapped for more than 2 weeks. Tuesday's rescue occurred on the third consecutive day of efforts to rescue the boys and their coach, who have been trapped in the Tom Luang cave complex since late June. Four boys were rescued Sunday and another four guided to safety on Monday. The remaining boys and their coach were pulled out Tuesday. Thailand's health secretary told reporters earlier Tuesday that two of the eight rescued boys had lung infections, but that all of them were generally healthy and in good spirits, thanks to their high immunity derived from being footballers. The boys are being quarantined from family members to prevent them from getting an infection and will likely be in the hospital for at least a week. Anmar Mirza is the national coordinator of the National Cave Rescue Commission. He tells me the success of the mission required international assistance.
This could not have been done by any one country's resources. There just simply are not enough really good cave divers in any one place in the world. Even, you know, United States and Great Britain and Australia don't have the number of people required. So it did require an international effort, and the Thai government is to be commended for the fact that they welcome that international help.
Do you remember any operation of this kind of magnitude in regard to a cave rescue?
There has been none. It's been unprecedented, and I've been doing cave rescue for 30 years and studying it all that time. There was a major operation that went on in the 1920s in the United States called Floyd Collins, but even then it was a fairly minor operation in comparison.
Well, in addition to everything else, I think most of these boys, if not all of them, didn't know how to swim. So this was a very complicated undertaking.
Absolutely. Now, they were aided by the fact that they had several days to practice and drill some of the skills that they needed, so that not only helped them actually get themselves out, but it kept them occupied during the time while they were waiting. It gave them a psychological boost from the standpoint of they're doing something to help themselves, and it built trust with their rescuers. And that last point there, I think, was probably the most critical aspect, is that if they could have that absolute trust with the divers who brought them out, that I think that was the biggest factor that led to the successful outcome.
Yeah, because I believe several of them were in there for several days with that football team.
Yeah, they had at least three divers with them at all times, and of course the divers who initially found them and were bringing supplies in with them stayed with them for quite some time, and it's those people are just absolutely commended, as well as, of course, the fact that the Thai diver who'd perished during the operation, we're just very glad that his sacrifice was not in vain.
You know, looking forward to other potential rescues from caves, what do you think the diving community or the cave rescue community can learn from this whole thing?
Well, we, and within the cave rescue community, we had never really done any significant practice with this kind of evacuation, of evacuating a non-diver with an experienced cave diver. You know, we've played around with it a little bit, and some people have experimented with it, but an evacuation on this scale is, again, it's unprecedented. We will be studying this operation for years, and it's not just the diving portion of it. It's actually the overall logistics of the management of the whole operation, as well as the number of people and personnel and equipment that was required to perform it. Again, the largest cave rescue operation I've been on maybe involved a couple of hundred people, and then this one involved thousands.
And I guess also this team and their coach ended up going in there. They didn't think there would be the amount of rains that they got. And I guess maybe in the future when people look at caves, they always have to consider the weather or how things can change.
Well, absolutely. One of the basic safe caving rules is to know how a cave you're going into responds to rain and know what the weather is going to do. And even then, you can get caught unawares. There can be, you know, the weather forecast is not perfect. There can be other conditions that were unforeseen that caused a cave to flood worse. But mostly, caving is a safe activity if done following the basic safe caving rules of letting somebody know where you're going and when you expect to be out, know what the weather is going to do and how the cave reacts, and having the basic equipment of helmets and lights and some supplies if you have to do wait for a little while.
Anmar Mirza, the National Coordinator of the National Cave Rescue Commission. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. President Donald Trump is en route to Europe to face U.S. allies. Tesla will build an auto plant in Shanghai. The United States praises Taiwan for aiding areas once controlled by Islamic State. And President Trump says migrants can solve the immigration issue by not entering the U.S. illegally. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have spotted and imaged the brightest object found so far in the ancient universe. The dazzling object is a quasar called P35215, and it's nearly 13 billion light years from Earth. This means the universe was only about 800 million years old when the light from this object started heading toward our planet. To make their discovery, the astronomers used the National Science Foundation's Very Long Baseline Array of telescopes. The astronomers say that the ancient quasar is split into three major components, which are spread over an area that's only 5,000 light-years wide. A quasar is formed when the gravitational pull of a supermassive black hole devours material so quickly it discharges very bright and energetic jets of particles traveling at nearly the speed of light. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Liu Xia, the widow of Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo, leaves China. President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, began meeting with senators Tuesday to shore up support for his nomination ahead of a major confirmation battle. Trump selected Kavanaugh to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. Kavanaugh has been a conservative leading federal judge for the past 12 years. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell praised the appellate judge as an impressive nominee who's extremely well qualified to sit on the nation's highest court. But outside the Supreme Court building, scores of demonstrators led by Democratic Party Senators Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren protested Kavanaugh's selection. Steve Laddick is professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law. He tells me how he believes Kavanaugh would impact the Supreme Court if Kavanaugh wins Senate confirmation.
Well, I think there's no question that a Justice Kavanaugh would move the court to the right on just about all of the issues that most people care about as compared to Justice Kennedy. You know, he has, I think, more sort of conventional conservative credentials. He has fairly strong and sharp views on, you know, topics ranging from constitutional interpretation to presidential power to the role of Congress vis-a-vis administrative agencies. So I think, you know, the confirmation of Justice Kavanaugh would mean really we would have a solid five-justice conservative majority on the court, the likes of which we really haven't seen in decades.
Will Kavanaugh's time working on the investigation of the death of Clinton White House counsel Vince Foster, and he was also involved in the Starr investigation of President Clinton, could that hurt him with the Senate Democrats?
I certainly think that Judge Kavanaugh's role in the Starr investigation and his views on the investigation, which he's published in several law review articles, are going to be part of the confirmation process, I believe it's part of the hearing, I certainly think they will be, you know, invoked as reasons why at least some Senate Democrats are opposed to his confirmation. But of course, the real question is whether it moves any Republicans to reconsider whether they would vote for him. I just have a hard time seeing how that's likely to happen. So I think it'll be, you know, a fair amount of noise. I'm not sure it's actually going to lead to anything substantive by the time we're done.
Well, one subject that's getting a lot of attention is, of course, the issue of abortion. And could Roe v. Wade be weakened if Kavanaugh joins the court?
Oh, I think it's likely that Roe v. Wade would be weakened. I'm not sure it's quite as clear that there'd be a solid majority to overrule Roe. I think the real question would be what kinds of cases would come to the court challenging Roe? What kinds of laws would states pass to try to provoke the court into revisiting Roe? And, you know, would the Supreme Court really consider squarely whether Roe is still a good precedent or not? Or would they just find a way to allow states to get away with deeper and deeper incursion into the right that Roe is supposed to protect? You know, I don't think Judge Kavanaugh would be a staunch defender of a woman's right to choose, but I also don't think he would be in a big hurry to overrule Roe. We probably end up with more of this, you know, iterative death by a thousand cuts, if you will.
Kavanaugh has written that he believes that sitting presidents should not be subject to civil litigation or criminal prosecution. Could that also be a matter of, you know, controversy when senators are determining whether or not to support him?
Oh, I think there's no question that Judge Kavanaugh's prior writings about whether a sitting president can be indicted or sued civilly is going to come up. I think the question that's not clear from his articles, from a 1998 article in the Georgetown Law Journal, from a 2009 article in the Minnesota Law Review, is whether he's making that argument on constitutional grounds, that he thinks a president can't be sued civilly and can't be indicted, or whether he just thinks that all things being equal, it ought not to happen, that it's unwise. And I suspect there will be at least some effort at his confirmation hearing to get him to clarify which of those two points he was making.
Yeah, because he does have a paper trail in this regard.
Yeah, I mean, unlike some of our most recent Supreme Court nominees, I think it's going to be difficult for Judge Kavanaugh to decline to answer at least some of these questions because he does have such an extensive record. I think the question is just going to be whether, you know, he actually expands upon any of his prior writings or whether he simply limits himself to clearing up confusion about what he may have said previously without saying anything about how that might lead him to rule or to approach a question that might come to him in the future.
Steve Laddick, professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law. Liu Xia, the Chinese poet and widow of dissident and Nobel Peace Laureate Liu Xiaobo, left the country after 8 years under strict house arrest. A spokesman for China's foreign ministry told reporters Tuesday that Liu Xia left Beijing for Germany to seek medical treatment. Her brother Liu Hui posted on social media earlier in the day that his sister had left China to start her new life in Europe. She arrived in Germany Tuesday. Liu Xia has been under house arrest since 2010 when her husband, a prominent writer, intellectual, and literary critic, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. The announcement of her departure came as Premier Li Keqiang ended a visit to Germany Tuesday. Liu Xia has never been charged with a crime and reportedly suffers from depression. Joseph Cheng is a retired professor from Hong Kong City University. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, China normally expels such dissidents, but appeared to have had a reason for delaying her departure.
It appears that the broad policy of the Chinese authorities is not to hold these people in China and allow these dissidents to go abroad where they cannot function properly. However, Madame Liu Xia was detained for one more year after Liu Xiaobo's death, probably because the Chinese authorities did not want her to make various comments in the international community regarding the ill treatment of Liu Xiaobo, especially in his final years in prison. So that explained the delay in sending her abroad, as well as the general policy of allowing these famous dissidents to leave China. However, as we were saying, the present policy is less generous in the sense that Liu Xia's brother has been still retained in China, meaning that there is a hostage against Madame Liu Xia to ensure that she will not speak too boldly against the Chinese authorities.
There's been no clear reason why she's been allowed to leave, except perhaps to seek medical attention. I understand she suffers from depression. Is that the reason, do you think?
Her health has been deteriorating, and her psychological and emotional state is probably alarming, especially to her friends. Obviously, Madame Liu Xia has not been charged, so the Chinese authorities have no legitimate reason to place her under house arrest and to deny her access to friends and media, domestic and international. Her treatment has well illustrated the rather illegal and inhumane treatment of dissidents in China as well as their family members.
Do you expect her to return to China?
I don't think so. I think in the first place, there is very little that she can do in China, and apparently she would like to have a good rest, at least to recover from her deteriorating health. And at the same time, one has to understand that even if she wants to go back, the Chinese authorities may not allow her to go back. And there are plenty of examples that the Chinese authorities do not allow dissidents residing overseas to go back to China.
Given her relative prominence, Joseph Cheung said he expects Liu Xia to travel and speak extensively depending on her health status. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Some students in Virginia who play the guitar are also learning how to build them. It's part of an after-school program where middle and high school students learn about science and music through the design and operation of an electric guitar. The workshops, sponsored by a nonprofit called Music for Life, are free for those who cannot afford to participate in the education program. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to a high school in Manassas, Virginia, where the students are learning the challenges of making an electric guitar.
Jaron Wildman is trying out the first electric guitar he built at this 12-day workshop at Osborne High School in Manassas, Virginia. He says he learned a lot about what it takes to put together a guitar.
If you get one thing wrong, even just by a millimeter, then the length of the string won't be right and you won't get the correct note on your strings.
Although the students use kits to build their guitars, which they get to keep, there is still plenty of work for them to do before they can take the instrument home. Not all the students play the guitar. Audrey Doan's interest in science brought her to the workshop to understand how a guitar functions.
There's a lot to do with electricity. It's a lot about grounding and how to conduct it to make music and how much is needed and how to make the notes the way you want it to be.
Which includes putting the strings on properly and tuning the instrument.
It keeps on going like high and then it keeps on going low. If, like, something out of place, then you can't really tune it.
Jenna Davis is feeling a little lost.
If you're okay here.
She gets help from Music for Life founder Skip Chapels.
And you're sharp here. That means your string is too short.
Chapels says while the workshops are about guitar making, they are also about providing the students with other skills.
Science that they may not have had before, but they also learn some very practical skills in woodworking, electronics, assembly, and test, which are good for any of the trades. So youth who have gone through this, they're getting an education which prepares them either for a career through college or going directly into the trades after school.
Kevin Hernandez, a guitarist who was his class president, hopes his instrument will help him reach for the stars. He appreciates that his Guatemalan parents, who are immigrants, are encouraging him to follow his dreams.
I'm trying to reach for the stars and trying to slowly progress in society. So we're living in a trailer right now, but one day, like, I want to express that, like, I touched the stars and that I made it.
Building a guitar is harder than it looks, says 11-year-old Jaden Borba.
There's a lot of different steps, and don't think it's just that it's, like, really easy to build it. It takes time and effort.
Lessons these students can use in the future, no matter where life leads them. Deborah Block, VOA News, Manassas, Virginia.
It must be very challenging building a guitar, never mind playing one. Well, anyway, for those food fans out there, I'm sure there are a lot of them, Asian food is the fastest growing cuisine here in the United States. Between 1999 and 2015, sales of Asian fast food soared 135%, far outpacing Latin and Middle Eastern cuisines. That's according to the market research firm Euromonitor. There are several factors driving the growth. According to the Pew Research Center, there were 20 million Asian Americans in 2017. That was up 72% since 2000, making Asians the fastest growing immigrant group in the country. Well, that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
1 year ago, the city of Mosul, ISIS's self-declared capital in Iraq, was liberated from ISIS by Iraqi security forces. The loss of its capital in Iraq cannot be overstated. The group's capture of the city on June 10, 2014, was a major propaganda coup for the terrorists and a blow to Iraq's security and stability. In early July, ISIS leader Abu Bakr Baghdadi declared a caliphate from the Grand Mosque of al-Nuri in Mosul's Old City. For 3 years, the terrorists brutalized the population, burned books, and destroyed the city's cherished antiquities. In late 2016, Iraqi forces began a campaign to retake Mosul. But as they were slowly pushed out of the city, the terrorists became ever more brutal. According to Amnesty International, ISIS rounded up thousands of civilians for use as human shields. They killed hundreds of civilians who attempted to flee and hanged their bodies in public areas. When Iraqi forces finally evicted ISIS from Mosul on July 10, 2017, the city lay in ruins. Over 500 buildings had been destroyed, including the al-Nuri Mosque. Nonetheless, the liberation of Mosul was a severe loss to ISIS. Not only did it represent a tremendous blow to the terrorists' prestige and the illusion of invulnerability ISIS cultivated, the city was its last strategic stronghold in Iraq, and its loss was the beginning of the end for their ambitions in Iraq. In the 12 months since the last ISIS fighter fled Mosul, much has changed. ISIS losses continue to mount, and today, having lost all its territory in Iraq, the terrorist group is fighting for its last footholds in Syria. In Mosul, the second part of freeing the city from the stain of ISIS, demining, rebuilding, and restoration of services, is well on the way. Under Iraqi leadership, the United States and global coalition partners are working closely with the UN to stabilize Mosul. Hundreds of thousands of its citizens are returning to homes they once fled. Children are going back to school, and markets are once again opening for business. Mosul will never be the same. Nonetheless, as it has done for over 2,500 years, it will survive.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.